CBS World News brings you the CBS Morning News Roundup with reports from its correspondents at home and abroad called in by Alan Jackson. But first, here are the highlights of the news as received up to 8 a.m. Eastern Wartime, Monday, August 6th. Tokyo reports a new Mustang raid. B-29s have hit four more Japanese cities. China reports the death of 50,000 civilians. Political developments spot the European news. Now here's Alan Jackson with a CBS feature, News of the World.
On a morning like this, the Japanese must be seriously concerned over the whereabouts of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, wondering if perhaps it isn't getting ready to let go another of its deadly punches. Headquarters has let through only enough to keep the Japanese stirred up. Hints and indications that Halsey and his battle outfit are still in Japanese waters and not too far from the Japanese homeland. High-ranking officers on his flagship are quoted as saying that the Third Fleet is now strong enough to steam straight into Tokyo Bay if necessary. And Admiral Jock McCain says that every enemy plane in Japan will be hunted down and destroyed before any invasion of the enemy country. And incidentally, there will have to be an invasion of Japan, just as rugged as any other in the Pacific, before the enemy surrenders. That's the opinion expressed by men around General MacArthur's headquarters, who say that air bombardment alone won't knock the Japs out of the war, that they'll have to be dug out of every cave on their homeland and exterminated. The Japanese radio this morning tells of another group of our Army Mustang fighter planes out on a new shooting-up attack against the Tokyo area. And B-29s have given four more Japanese towns what they promised to give them, a heavy pasting from the air. For details on that and other Pacific developments, we take you now to Pacific Fleet Advance Headquarters on Guam, Webley Edwards reporting.
Headquarters of Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz today issued a press release as a gentle reminder that while pursuant to a directive from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, control of U.S. held areas and U.S. Army forces in the Ryukyus, passed to General Douglas MacArthur, control of all naval and naval air forces, naval bases, and naval installations there remain under the Commander-in-Chief U.S. Pacific Fleet. The press release says that changes in the Ryukyu's command arrangements became effective on July 31st. Press officers here say it has been in preparation for a number of days. It was issued after the announcement from Manila concerning the Ryukyu's command. The Manila story mentioned Lieutenant General Jimmy Doolittle's 8th Air Force in the Okinawa's area was under separate command, but made no mention of other parts of, quote, detailed arrangements made in conference at Guam, July 21 to 23, and subsequently approved by Nimitz and MacArthur. In short, this is not an official statement, but an obvious interpretation. The Navy here wants it on the record that, one, General MacArthur is Commander-in-Chief, U.S. Army Forces Pacific, and now takes command of U.S. areas and U.S. Army Forces in the Ryukyus. And two, that Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief Pacific Fleet, retains control of naval bases and naval installations there. And three, that units of the U.S. Army Strategic Air Force, that's the B-29s, remain under its commanding officer, General Carl Spott, and that the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington are in overall command. Navy spokesman here said the release was intended to clarify the situation. Meanwhile, 20th Air Force Headquarters here announced four more secondary Jap industrial cities and war plants bombed this morning. At least 580 B-29s dropped about 3,850 tons of incendiaries and high explosives. And a small force of superforts hit Crook's Moen Airfield No. 1 with 45 tons of bombs. The 98 Mustang fighters strafed and rocketed the Tokyo area. A Navy search plane struck off Honshu, a truck up China, and in the Kuriles. This is Webley Edwards at Guam. I return you to CBS in New York.
In Europe, the Marshal Pétain trial goes into its third week today, with defense witnesses scheduled to resume their testimony after a two-day interruption which permitted the court to hear Pierre Laval. For that story and other news, we take you to CBS Paris, Charles Collingwood reporting.
Good morning. The Pétain trial goes into its third week today after the dramatic two-day deposition of Pierre Laval. Marshal Pétain's defense attorneys still have many witnesses to call. One of them is General Juin, who now commands the French army and who commanded in North Africa when we landed and first fought us and then surrendered. Another defense witness who brings back memories of the North African days will be Marcel Perrouton, who was Pétain's Minister of Interior in Vichy and whom we later brought to Algiers over the protests of General de Gaulle's supporters as Governor General. Other important figures will appear as the defense seeks to show that whatever Marshal Pétain did during the German occupation, it was not treason. There is also considerable activity here on the international scene. Much of it is concerned with France's neighbor, Spain. Paris seems to believe that it is only a matter of days before the Franco government bows out. Both to hasten this process and avoid trouble when the moment comes, the French have closed their border with Spain. The whole length of France's border with Spain is now a prohibited area, or only open to regular residents. Spain is also involved in the Tangier Conference, which will finally open in Paris this week. The conference has been called to settle the international status of the port of Tangier after Spain marched in and seized power there during the war. The conference has been delayed because of Russia's demand to be included. The British, in particular, did not see that Russia had any special interest in that end of the Mediterranean. But now the question has been settled, and the Russians will participate, along with Britain, France, and the United States, in the discussions about the future of the African port, which, with the Rock itself, controls the Straits of Gibraltar. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to CBS in New York.
Our correspondent in Britain this morning has news for us on the British train strike and the story of wooden warships. For that news, we take you to CBS London, Douglas Edwards reporting.
Britain today is in the beginning of what may turn out to be a very disrupting railway strike. Bank holiday train service in the Liverpool area is seriously affected because 600 workers at one of the big stations there have decided to continue their walkout, which began yesterday. Between 40 and 50 trains to all parts of Lancashire have been cancelled today, and yesterday Liverpool was a city almost without train service of any kind. There's been interference with schedules in various other parts of Britain. And with the terrific holiday travel crowds, it's been very unpleasant for a great many people. The strikes have kept 9,000 soldiers of the British Army in Calais. Train service was so curtailed, they couldn't be accommodated on this side of the Channel. There's a new black market scandal this morning involving huge quantities of food, mainly tea and canned milk, which should have been shipped from Britain to the American forces on the continent. Those provisions have been finding their way into the black market here. American agents and British detectives are working together on the case, and their investigations have covered a wide area of southern England. Some of the stolen goods have been traced to hotels and restaurants in southern counties, including Dorset, Sussex, and Hampshire. Also out this morning is the story of another ingenious defense method used by the British in the war against Germany. For the first 2 years of the war, the British Navy used a fleet of four wooden warships to confuse enemy aircraft and U-boats. The ships, three merchantmen and one old battleship, were fitted with elaborate superstructures of plywood and canvas and with dummy guns. They were used as bait for U-boats to draw air attack from the ship base at Scapa Flow and in the Firth of Forth when the fleet was away. The device also served to reduce the scale of attack on the fleet and to keep the enemy guessing about the disposition of Britain's capital ships. And that's the news picture in London.
Chinese forces today are continuing to press closer on the town of Ling Ling, a former airbase of the old Flying Tigers outfit. Chung King, meantime, has added a tragic note, reporting that the once beautiful city of Guilin has been sacked by the Japanese with a thoroughness comparable to the Roman sacking of Carthage. OWI correspondent David Chandler says that Guilin, once a city of a 500,000 population, was ravaged with a fury reminiscent of Lidice. Japanese squads, for 20 days before they fled the city, systematically set sections of the big town afire. Traders in Guilin were given $3,000 Chinese money for every building they destroyed. Even the trees lining the main street were scorched and dead. The modern buildings, lavish hotels, and beautiful shops were in ruins. The only buildings left standing in the entire city were those which the Japanese used as headquarters and had no time to destroy. Everything else, every building and every coolie hut, was a mass of rubble in the once beautiful town of Guilin, China. The USS Augusta, maintaining a 26-knot speed most of the time, is nearing the East Coast today, bringing home President Truman and his party from the Potsdam Conference. A number of problems await the chief executive's return to Washington, among them the growing dispute about the size of the Army and decisions on post-war policing duties of American troops. One suggestion on the latter has come from Senator Vandenberg. So for that news and other developments, we take you now to CBS Washington, Joe McCaffrey reporting.
About an hour ago, one of the leaders in opposing the old League of Nations, and who had little sympathy with the United Nations Charter, Senator Hiram Johnson, California Republican, died at Bethesda, Maryland Naval Hospital. Johnson's political activities extended over a third of a century and covered some of the most vital years in the nation's history. He was first elected to Congress in 1916 and took part in many fights. But the one for which he will be remembered is the fight against President Wilson's League of Nations covenant. Meanwhile, there are two plans now ready here for legislation to authorize use of American troops under the United Nations Charter, for which Senator Johnson cast no vote. Administration leaders have a simple proposal, which would fix the status of our delegate to the World Security Council as that of an ambassador. His selection would be confirmed by the Senate, and he would be a deputy of the president. The president would decide how this country should vote on the use of our armed forces in quelling aggression, and there'd be no limitation on the number of troops. Senator Vandenberg, on the other hand, has proposed that the president have a free hand to vote for the use of American military units assigned by Congress to the Security Council, but he would be required to obtain prior congressional consent for any additional forces. The Republican senator would have the president report currently to Congress whenever he voted for sanctions or the use of force. Vandenberg also suggests that the United States and its inter-American allies assume the responsibility for armed forces required to maintain peace in this hemisphere. But meanwhile, the fight over the size of the Army continues, and there appears to be little doubt but that it will have to be settled by President Truman himself. The sooner an end to the current squabble, the better. For all the statements being tossed around that 3 million more men could be released from the Army if the Army wished to release them isn't helping the morale of men who have spent 4 or 5 years in uniform. It's a safe bet that the president will throw his weight behind the military. For all administration spokesmen who have commented to date give their full support to the Army and the Navy. However, members of the House and Senate Military Affairs Committee are charging that the Army's insistence in keeping a force of 7 million men for the rest of the war has helped to kill any chance there might be of passage of a peacetime draft act. This is Joe McCaffrey in Washington, returning you to Alan Jackson in New York.
The world's largest airplane in operation, the Hawaii Mars, made a high-speed emergency landing in Chesapeake Bay yesterday, and the impact of landing on the water at 120 miles an hour cracked open the hull, and the big ship began to sink. Fortunately, the water is only about 25 feet deep at that point in the bay, and so that all of the 72.5-ton flying boat did not go completely under the water. The tail and the tip of one wing remain above the surface. The plane was launched only a couple of weeks ago as the first of 20 such transports being constructed for the Navy. The Glenn Martin Company, builders of the plane, say it will be raised to the surface and taken back to its Baltimore plant for overhauling. And that's the top news from Baltimore. Bernard Baruch, in a letter published in the communist newspaper Daily Worker, says that he believes Americans will be able to deal with the Russians on a friendly basis. Said Baruch, "If all of us were wise, we would find some common ground on which we could live in peace, because there is so much in the world for everyone which could be made available if we but used half the wisdom and intelligence with which we are endowed." The giant liner Queen Mary has taken aboard nearly 900 passengers in preparation for a return voyage to England beginning this morning. There are 729 Army-Navy personnel aboard, and the civilian passenger list includes 2 congressional committees and nationals of more than a dozen nations. In today's CBS Morning News Roundup, you've heard the reports of Wembley Edwards at Guam, Charles Collingwood in Paris, Douglas Edwards in London, and Joe McCaffrey in Washington. This is Alan Jackson reporting from New York. This program has come to you from CBS World News. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.